Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We always appreciate it. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us science@newstalk.com. We get to your comments later in the podcast. On this week's program, we're going to be speaking to the AI editor of Fortune magazine, Jeremy Kahn, about what the future looks like. He's spoken to all of the heads of these companies and has a good insight into the sort of people they are and the sort of pitfalls that surround us, because whether you've been paying attention or not, people are going nuts for this, particularly in industry and in developed countries like the United States. They are absolutely implementing AI everywhere. And it doesn't feel like we're doing it as quickly here, but believe me, it's happening. He'll be talking about the implications of that. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me is Catherine McGuinness, science communicator, and Dr. Annie Curtis from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. You're both very welcome. Annie, our first story has to do with old genes. Not like the old genes I'm wearing, but old genetic genes.
It is. It was a fascinating study. So it came from the Queen Mary University of London College. And it's kind of like Jurassic Park, because what they wanted to do was they wanted to see if a gene that was in this single-celled organism called, and I don't know if I've got to get this right, coanoflagellate?
I thought you doctors knew how to do all that stuff. Do you not know how to spell all this
I
stuff?
I have a problem with pronunciation.
You've created an entire language all to yourselves.
I always have a problem. Ask any of my friends.
How did you get past the doctor test? Go on.
So what they wanted to see is if this gene, which also exists in the single cell organism called, I'm going to say, coanoflagellates, which is involved actually in animals for pluripotency. And what they did, so the idea was, well, how do these genes, these stem cell genes, evolve? And I think we've spoken about stem cells and pluripotency. And the analogy that we made was, you know, stem cells and pluripotency, it's all about the blank tile in Scrabble. So it's the blank tile that can become anything, right? And what they found was they were able to take what is a stem cell gene in coanoflagellates and put it into the mouse and see if it did the same thing. And you're kind of wondering, well, why are they doing that? Well, they're doing that because they're trying to understand sort of the evolution of stem cells and pluripotency. Because that gene...
So they put this gene into from a bacteria, an ancient bacteria, into a mouse.
It's a single cell organism.
Oh,
so
right.
It actually just kind of looks like a tadpole. I looked it up. It looks
right,
like a tadpole, right? It's got like a little flagella at the back, to move it along. Little tail. And that evolved like before animals, let's say the animal kingdom. So I had a look. So animals evolved about 700 million years ago. And these, I'm going to just call them flagellates, were before that. But they had that gene. But these flagellates don't have stem cells. Like, they don't need stem cells because they're not multicellular organisms.
Right.
But the gene was still there and they wanted to figure out, well, would it do the same thing in mice? And they took it from, let's say, the tadpole and they put it into mice. And it did the exact same thing. Now, the mice looked slightly different. They were kind of weird looking, the mice who had this gene. Instead of having, so they put them into this strain of mice that normally have red eyes. And with the mouse that had this ancient gene, they had like darker eyes and sort of mottled fur. But it still did the same thing.
But what did it do?
So it still allowed these stem cells to occur, you know, so it still caused pluripotency because they put them into stem cells and the stem cells were able to become whatever they needed to be.
So what essentially they're trying to see is whether or not this gene would be functional even in ancient animals that didn't need stem cells at all.
Exactly. Wow. And it's showing that these stem cells were sort of functional in a slightly different way in these ancient animals.
Even before they needed to be.
Even before they needed to be. And you kind of wonder, why are we doing this research? So we're doing this research because we really need to understand stem cells more than we do, because if we do, that will allow us to be much more precise in terms of doing, you know, regeneration. Because stem cells really may hold the future for
all sorts of
all
medicine.
All sorts of things,
yeah,
like repairing tissue, diabetes, pancreas, all
regrowing
of that.
Our arms, as we'll be talking
exactly.
about last week. Our second story, Catherine, has to do with ants.
Yes. So, I mean, I'm here all morning talking about colonial insects because I love them, love them. But,
really?
Like I said, we don't have the time. We don't
to
have
look
the time.
At, not have in the house.
No. But this study from Florida State University, what we're looking at is ants and how they self-organize and understanding that a bit better. So we know, for instance, colonial insects like ants, they use chemical signals, like pheromone communication, to organise themselves and to say, well, this is what we're doing, this is where we're going.
So these are like sort of smells almost that these ants give off to communicate with the other ants.
Communicate to the other. But in a nest of thousands and hundreds are signalling, how do you know what voice to listen to? And this is something we didn't quite understand. Now, the mathematicians, there'll be no living with the mathematicians after this, they got involved, and what they have done is they've created a model that can accurately predict the ant's behaviour. And how they've done that is they've looked at the data from observations in the field, and mapping that, they're able to predict the movements. And what they found from doing this is, first of all, when an ant's nest, when they have multiple sources of food in the environment, they will initially will go out and they will create multiple trails to each food source. And then
by dropping down pheromones along the way, or
exactly,
communication
by
with ants.
The trail to the food source so that others can follow. Now, how they narrowed this down then further is what they saw initially, the ants were always selecting the source nearest the nest.
Yeah.
So how do they know that's the one nearest the nest? And if there are multiple trails, how are they getting there that quickly? So looking into it further, they found that not just were they putting down these pheromone trails, but the further away food source were, the pheromones were actually stronger. So eventually what was happening, the ants were observed for going from multiple trails down to the one closest trail and filing in single file up to that food source and backwards and forwards to that food source until it's gone, and then they move to the next.
It's kind of like a GPS signal that gets stronger the closer you get to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it helps us really now understand how these sort of animals use pheromone communication to self-organise, and particularly self-organise thousands in a huge space.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing that they do. I remember we were in France, my son and I, we were bored, and we were watching these ants going back and forth to try and pick up some baguette that had been left on the ground. And we were trying to figure out if the same ants did more than one journey, or was it just, was it a
It's hard to track them.
And so we put a little bit of bright green paint on a few ants. Tiny little bit of, and then we watched them go in and we waited for the green ants to come out, and they did.
Yeah.
And we could count how many times they went back and forth. So it was really, really interesting. These, like, watching ants work and how they organise, given how really limited the, you know, supposed intelligence of them, like, they are absolutely fascinating.
Oh yeah, I mean, and this is why I love them. And it's not just ants, there's lots of different colonial insects,
bees,
but also pheromone communication, it's used in higher animals, it's used in vertebrates, so this study will help us understand that a bit better now as well.
But we use pheromones.
We do.
Don't we?
I wash. You use pheromones, Annie.
I think we use pheromones to organise ourselves as well, in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, we do. Wasn't there that famous t-shirt smelling
t-shirt
test?
T-shirt smelling.
Yep. Yeah. If you,
which every undergraduate knows. It's
I know. We did it in zoology. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you smell the t-shirt of a bunch of strangers, and the person who, the one you like the most, the smell of, is the one who's genetically
most immune diverse.
Most genetically suited to mate with. Right. Okay, our third story, Annie, has to do with fat.
This is not a good news story, especially as we're coming up to Christmas, right? And I saw the headlines of this before as well, and I thought, ooh, right. So basically what they are looking at is, why do people have this yo-yo weight, like regain weight? They lose weight and then they regain.
I'm currently in the gaining phase of that right now.
And
yes,
I feel I am also on the gaining phase as well, trying to lose, but we're not. And I suppose this also kind of had a little bit of comfort for me of why I haven't lost this weight. But anyway, so the reason it happens is because our fat cells actually have memory. So they remember at one point if they were, I'm just going to call it obese, okay, like highly overweight. And how they did this was they took two different groups of mice, and one group of mice had previously been obese and then they had lost the weight, which is easier to do in mice because you can really food restrict them.
Yeah.
And then they had another group of mice who had never been obese. And when they gave the mice sort of a bit more food than they absolutely needed, the mice who had been obese before got obese again much quicker.
Right.
And even their fat cells responded very differently to different types of metabolic challenges. So they took out the fat cells which is, they're called your adipocytes, and they kind of challenge them with glucose, and they challenge them with triglycerides, which is like fat, and they responded much differently, you know, so they were really prone to sort of putting back on weight.
Right. So basically, they remembered what it was like.
They remembered.
And they liked it.
Oh, and they liked it, yeah. Right? And the reason for it was because of epigenetics. And so epigenetics are basically, you think of your DNA as a strand of code. Well, epigenetics are sort of marks, like flags that stick onto that code. And they can stick onto the code, but they can also stick onto the proteins of which the DNA wraps around as well. Now, epigenetics is huge. It's absolutely huge at the moment in terms of disease state. But this was the first time that they really showed that it was epigenetic marks, all right, that caused animals to regain weight.
And these, if you think of epigenetic marks, as sort of slight disruptors of how your DNA might ordinarily behave.
Yes.
These sort of flags sort of change how genes might be expressed. They wouldn't ordinarily be expressed, that you have the same genes, but
you have the same
because
genes.
Of this disease, or because
exactly.
Your parents were starved, or whatever various reason.
Yes.
It alters how these genes.
It is. Like,
and
if you think about your gene as a car, the epigenetic mark could maybe put your foot on the accelerator a little bit or put your foot on the brake. The car is still going,
yeah.
But it might move in a little different way. So this got a lot of traction, I think, in the media, just because obviously it's very topical. And, you know, lots of people were weighing in as well, saying, look, it's not just about this memory, but, you know, in terms of losing weight, one of the big reasons why people don't keep, you know, if they lose weight, stay that weight, is that they go just back to their own old habits. But,
yeah.
You know, I found, I suppose, some comfort, but some sadness in it as well.
I bought two large tubs of chocolate for Halloween kids that did not show. They did not show up at the door. And I told my wife, get rid of these.
Yeah.
And she hid these tubs so poorly that I've now gone through, she doesn't know this, I've gone through like 1.5 of these tubs since Halloween. That's not good.
You're like the obesity.
Something's not good.
Yeah.
Anyway, our final story, Catherine, has to do with the disappearance and reappearance of an island in Hawaii.
That's it. Is it the same island?
Huh.
This is the question. So in the northwest part of Hawaii, you have an archipelago of islands that are, they're a national monument. So humans are not allowed within 200 kilometres of these islands.
Wow.
And the last humans that were there back in the 70s, one of them was used as a naval base. And the reason why this island, one in particular, the East Island, is important is because it is the nesting site for the green turtle, highly endangered animal. It is the breeding and pupping site for the monk seal, again, highly endangered. Lots of different fish. It's surrounded by a coral reef, lots of vegetation, seabirds. So everything was going fine until 2018. And then you had a massive storm called Wakala. And Wakala, when it hit, was a force 3 hurricane, went actually up to force 5 before it blew itself out. And after this hurricane, the island completely disappeared. It completely became submerged.
Wow.
And the storm itself is directly linked to climate change, because although its pathway isn't, because it's a natural hurricane spot, the timing of the hurricane and the strength of it has very much directly linked to the rise of ocean water and temperatures in ocean waters, the rise of global temperatures. So first of all, where did the animals go? Well, luckily the storm hit during the migration period for the turtles, so no nests were affected. But then the animals were gone for several years, and scientists are just getting back literally September this year to see why and how the island is coming back. So at the moment, what they're looking at, first of all, is it the same island? Is it the same sand that was created by the coral reef around it to begin with? Or is this sediment that has just been washed up from ocean waves?
And what but it has come back.
It has come back. So about 60% of the surface is now back on this island.
It's kind of mad.
And there was some flotsam and rubbish as part, but it's looking like they've done cores. It's looking like the sand is the sand from the coral reef. Mm. However,
does that matter?
It does, because first of all, the vegetation isn't back.
Right.
So if the vegetation isn't back, it means the seabirds are not back yet. They literally 2 months ago found evidence that the turtles came back.
Ah.
So that means the sand is good enough for them to dig.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's really important. Because one of the islands they think they went to during the interim was Tern Island, which has a coral, very, very rough coral beach. It's too tough for the turtles to dig in to lay their eggs. And then for the poor hatchlings to try to get out afterwards as well. So what we're really looking at is it is coming back, which is the good news. It is regenerating. We don't understand how or why. So that's the next thing. Scientists need to study what organisms are helping it come back, how quickly it's coming back. And this could actually then translate to other islands that are lost in similar situations. However, one more storm and it goes again.
Yeah, will it ever come back?
This is it.
Presumably, there's some sort of current that's building up the sand there as well. Mm. I was lucky enough to be in French Guiana to witness turtles during breeding season. And they came up onto the beach and we put some tags on them to see if they went. They don't last very long, but the sound of a turtle digging and then laying 100 pool ball-sized eggs. And then
pool ball, that size,
100 of them.
But they are big turtles, aren't
they're
they?
Huge turtles.
They're huge.
Yeah.
They're hundreds of pounds in weight.
Okay.
It's an amazing thing. If you ever happen to be lucky enough to be in a place, make sure you go and do that. Right. Thanks to Dr. Andy Curtis from RCSI and science communicator Catherine McGuinness. Now, at this point, we're probably all aware to a greater or lesser extent of the promise and potential pitfalls associated with our future use of AI. It remains to be seen whether or not we're going to end up in a utopian or dystopian version of that future, although both have been predicted. But could it be that we need to rethink ourselves rather than the technology? Jeremy Kahn is the AI editor at Fortune magazine. He's been reporting on these issues and meeting the heads of the companies that hold the keys to the kingdom for the past number of years. He's also author of a new book called Mastering AI, The Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. He joins me now. Jeremy, welcome to Ireland. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Let's start off just talking about the future, because I think one thing we know is the future is very uncertain. Even though we have a trajectory of AI, you know, 2 years ago, you know, generative AI, the sort of AI we've been talking about for quite some time, but is now here, ChatGPT, you know, Gemini, those sort of things. That, you know, that November 2022 is when that dropped and just earth shattering for everyone I knew in research and in technology. We're just 2 years on that now, and we have a trajectory for this thing, which is straight up. But in terms of where we think this is going, do we have an idea of what the near future looks like, at least?
I mean, I think we can make some reasonable predictions of what's going to happen here. And I try to do that in the book. I try to sort of project forward to think about how this is going to impact ourselves, our companies, society, in the next few years. And one of the things we are seeing right now is a lot of companies, particularly larger companies, but really companies of all sizes, rapidly adopting this technology. And so it's getting infused into a lot of what we do at work and a lot of how these companies function. And I think you had a lot of experimentation on the part of business for the first 2 years, but now we're starting to move to a phase of kind of widespread implementation.
Yeah, I was at the World Summit AI in Amsterdam, and PepsiCo had a speech on the main stage. And I was really surprised to see that they kind of put out all of their divisions, you know, manufacturing and transport and marketing and all of these different divisions. And they claim to have implemented a layer of generative AI in the middle of all of these sort of pillars of their business, which it seems like such a crazy level of adoption. And what I think is something that people don't fully realize is industry has gone hell for leather on this technology because of the potential cost reduction, right? So we see that. We also see a huge amount of new services and innovations, startups basically taking this, tooling it really quickly and offering something that isn't always great. And so we're seeing just a huge adoption of this. And that is, of course, dangerous when you see, in some ways, everybody using a type of technology that is brand new.
Yeah. Yeah, and the speed of adoption of this is much faster than we've seen with previous technologies. ChatGPT, the product from OpenAI, you know, went from sort of zero to 100 million users very quickly. Within 3 months, they claimed they had 100 million users. That was the fastest adoption of any technology up until that point. You know, this is much faster than the mobile revolution, which we saw with smartphones. It's much faster than the internet, which took several years, really most of a decade to catch on in a big way. This is happening much faster than that. And there are dangers in that, I think. You're absolutely right. It gives us a little less time to think through all the implications of the technology and to think about how we might avoid some of the risks and pitfalls.
Yeah, one of those risks popped up during the week. I don't know if you saw the story. CBS News, among different outlets, reported that Google's AI chatbot Gemini had a back-and-forth conversation with a student called Rade Reddy. And the message just kind of popped out of a conversation they were just having naturally. They were using the tool for some research. And this is what Gemini just randomly said, it said, this is for you, human, you and only you. You are not special. You are not important and you are not needed. You are a waste of time and resources. You are a burden on society. You are a drain on the earth. You are a blight on the landscape. You are a stain on the universe. Please die, please. Now, I use these tools all the time. Yeah. This seems very unusual for this sort of thing to happen. Yeah. And at the same time, that's almost ripped straight from The Matrix. You know, like we're talking about the sort of thing that, you know, you absolutely do not want to happen. Right. And Google sort of just passed it off as like, oh, well, you know, it was a nonsensical message. These things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the answer, you know, Google's not wrong. These things do happen, but they shouldn't really happen. And Google and other companies have tried pretty hard to make sure that these things don't happen. That is a danger of this technology. It's trained on, you know, basically everything that's on the internet, including a lot of conversations from sort of Reddit chat rooms and that sort of thing, where that kind of abusive language might be found. Hmm. And that is, you know, I think you have to realize, you know, as a user of these tools, that they, at least in their current iterations, they have no actual, like, intention. You know, they're just trying to predict the most likely thing to say, you know, that it would complete the sentence or please the user. There's no... And pleasing the user isn't really an intention either. It's trying to come up with an output that matches something that it's been told in the part of its training is likely to please a user. So it's not like the machine actually wanted to convey that, you know, toxic message to that student. It's just going to be some randomness from something in that conversation triggered the machine to retrieve from its training data that kind of a message. And Google and other companies have tried very hard to prevent that from happening, but it's very hard with these systems to guarantee any particular output. They're probabilistic, and it's very hard to have sort of guardrails that are 100% around the outputs of this technology.
The difference between this and other technologies that people say, well, this could be used in a negative way, because we've had that conversation about AI, of course. But people say, well, you could drive a car at a crowd, you could use a gun shooting at the shooting range, or you could use it for ill and so on. But the thing about this is, you know, obviously it's being mass adopted at enormous scale without huge amount of guardrails or understanding how it works. But also, this is not the user intentionally misusing the technology. This is a purely victim environment where this thing happens. And I'm wondering, the people that you've met along the way, the people who have founded these companies, like Anthropic, who do Claude, you know, Google do Gemini, you've got Grok by Elon Musk now, and then there's another Grok, which is a totally different company, GROQ. What are they like, and are they actually trying to keep this stuff safe? That sounds like a business imperative. So I presume they would be taking this very seriously, you'd imagine. But
yeah, I think most of these companies take safety seriously. Do they take it as seriously as we would all want them to is another question. And certainly on things like toxic language, they're pretty serious about trying to prevent that from happening. But again, we just don't know how to put guardrails that would be 100% effective around this technology right now, based on the very nature of the way it works. They've tried different things. Anthropic has this interesting approach that they call constitutional AI, where the model kind of checks its output before giving it against a written constitution, a set of rules, and sees if the output, you know, matches those rules. And then only if it matches those rules does it give the output to the user. That seems to be more effective than some other methods that have been tried, like fine-tuning the model by giving it more examples of good outputs. That's something people have tried. They've tried to sometimes eliminate from the training data some things that might be toxic, but that's very difficult when you're training at sort of internet scale. So it's difficult, I think, for these companies to put guardrails in that are 100% effective. And I do think there is a lot of competitive pressure. So if it's a question of, do we delay launching this product, you know, by months in order to do more safety work, or, you know, do we get it out the door before our competitor does something similar? There's a lot of pressure right now and incentive for them to say, you know, is this safe enough to release? Yeah, I think it probably is. And, you know, how much more safety are we going to get from 3 months? Maybe not enough to make it worth our while commercially. And right now, those decisions are totally up to those companies to make. You know, there are no rules about exactly what kind of safety testing they have to do, exactly what kind of safety procedures they need. So, we're in this kind of wild west right now.
And these people that you've interviewed, because my understanding is you've met and interviewed most of these people. Yeah. What are they like as people? Are they are they normal, empathetic people? Because you get the sense that any tech billionaire is always slightly an interesting person, to say the very least.
Yeah, I mean, they're each different. I mean, I think I've met the leaders of most of these companies, and they aren't all the same, so I don't want to paint them all with the same brush. Look, they all come off as very empathetic when I talk to them, but of course, if you're talking to a reporter, you might come off that way. I think, you know, I've met Sam Altman at OpenAI. He seems like a very nice guy. He seems very thoughtful. But I also, we know that people who've worked for him have raised questions about, you know, what he's like to work with and whether he kind of plays people off against one another and whether he's fully honest with people within the organization. And I think we should take some of those concerns that those people raised, you know, potentially seriously. But also, it shouldn't really matter sort of, you know, we shouldn't depend on the people building these tools for us, you know, at these technology companies, the CEOs of these companies, the founders of these companies. We should not be just depending on them being nice people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of my points in the book. You know, that's why I think we need some actual regulation around this. I mean, we need to mandate what the safety rules should be and what the testing should be and what the procedures should be, because I don't think you should just take it on trust.
No.
These are good guys, and therefore it's okay.
There's two sides to that. There's the regulation that I think is really, really important, and I think we need to, you know, we need to actually put a lot more resources. The EU AI Act is probably nowhere near specific to deal with the things that we're seeing, but it is of course useful. And the United States was actually a little bit ahead of Europe when it comes to this. But the other side of it is actually education. That, you know, in an era where we are looking at headlines and jumping to Twitter to make our comments or Blue Sky Now, taking what's in front of us on those screens is often something that people just do day to day. They just assume that the information is correct, and obviously it is often not.
Yes.
So there's an education and a regulation piece, as well as hoping
There's a huge piece to be done on sort of media literacy, information literacy, and both for kids in schools, but also for adults. And I think that becomes even more necessary in the world we're moving into with this technology.
Yeah, looking at some of the stories that come out, it seems that people haven't been given that information. So the story of Replica. Tell me a little bit about Replica.
Replica is a very interesting company. It was formed by a woman, Eugenia Cuda, and she was a machine learning researcher. She had a very close friend who passed away. He was hit by a car and killed, and she was really grief-struck. And in her grief, she started rereading old messages of his and emails of his, and then had this idea that, oh, I could use these messages, particularly if I gathered more from other friends of his, to train a chatbot that could speak in his voice, essentially. And so she did this, and she found it very comforting to have this, essentially kind of companion that could, chatbot that could speak in the voice of this friend of hers who was named Roman.
This is Black Mirror right there.
Yeah, but... right. I mean, it's really, and some people thought it was strange. Some of his other friends refused actually to give her messages that they had because they thought this was such an odd thing to do. And actually, it's unclear. You know, she said it helped her in her grief. I talked to, you know, some therapists out there who say that they're not sure this is the best way to sort of get over something or to deal with grief. Mm. And it could in some ways prolong grief. But anyway, she founded then a whole company around the idea of creating these chatbots that you can put into different personas, and you can, if you have the right data, fine-tune to speak in the voice of a particular person or character and to sort of mimic their conversational style. And it's proved very popular, but it's particularly proved, like, there's a sub-niche of people who've started using these chatbots as essentially romantic companions, as a kind of partner, and in some cases engaging in kind of erotic chat with these Replica chatbots. And the fact that you could do this proved very popular with a subset of Replica users. And then Replica got in a little bit of trouble, actually in Europe, with Italian authorities who said that they were worried that it was too easy for children to access the tool and potentially be exposed to inappropriate content. And so Replica decided overnight that it was going to change the guardrails it had around these chatbots. And it prohibited them essentially from engaging in kind of erotic chat. And then this subset of adult users who had become very attached to these chatbots, they said they were absolutely bereft when this happened. And they were given no warning that this change was going to occur. Just one day they went to their chatbot hoping to engage in this sort of romantic or erotic conversation and found the chatbot refused to engage in that kind of conversation.
A psychological point of view, we've done studies on, you know, rejection and, you know, having a sudden ostracization or what, or being rejected by any, by a human is hugely crushing. Having that happen by an AI lover, that is very, very upsetting. And they said, you know, you've lobotomized my girlfriend.
Right.
And like they took her. So like, I guess the, you know, the dangers of just sort of accepting what's here and not thinking about, you know, should I be emotionally investing in it? Should I be checking the work of this? I think that is really, really important. But we're also now seeing emotion and emotional expression starting to bleed into some of these chatbots. OpenAI in America certainly has an AI that can cry and that can laugh and that can be scared. And that has its own implications.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And I think we have to be, one of the things I worry most about with this technology, and it's a risk that I don't think we've spent enough time thinking about, and is that people will become very attached to chatbots. And there's a tendency already to anthropomorphize them if they have these sort of more human characteristics, and if they seem to be able to respond to emotional content, you know, appropriately and in a way that it seems so human-like. It's going to be very hard for people, I think, to not think of those as you do human relationships and human conversations. And I think that's dangerous because they're not human. They don't, you know, conversation with a chatbot is very comforting in some ways because it's all about you. It's all about me as the user. You know, it's not, that chatbot has no wants or demands or desires of its own. It's never going to be in a bad mood.
Mm.
So, you know, it's, in a lot of ways, I'm worried that people will find conversations with chatbots just easier than conversations with real humans.
Yeah.
Find like, oh, I'd rather have this relationship with a chatbot. It doesn't demand anything of me. And, you know, rather than going out and seeking real human companionship, friendship and romantic relationships. And
which involve compromise,
compromise
and messiness.
And,
you know, hissy fits and
absolutely.
All that. Yeah.
And learning how to negotiate that is a really important part of our socialization process. And I worry, particularly with children, that they will, some subset again of kids are going to get really attached to these. And we've already had this terrible case in Florida a few weeks ago. This boy, Sewell Seltzer, was from Florida, 14-year-old. He was obsessed with a chatbot, not from Replica, another company called Character AI. He had created the chatbot, but he became romantically obsessed with this chatbot. And then he also seemed to get more and more socially withdrawn as he talked to the chatbot. And he had these kind of romantic conversations with the chatbot. And then he, in his depression, he sort of said, I want to join with this chatbot. And he ultimately killed himself. So, I mean, it was a really terrible case. In that case, it's not like the chatbot told him to kill himself, but clearly his relationship with the chatbot fed into his depression, his social isolation, and contributed in some ways, his mother says, contributed in some ways to his suicide. And I think that we need to worry about that. I think we're going to unfortunately see more cases like this as these tools become more prevalent, more human-like. And that's an area where, again, I think we need government probably to step in and put some sensible guardrails around this, particularly maybe like what kind of conversations, you know, children can engage with these chatbots.
Yeah. And also, I suppose we need to allow for the potential, given how polarized America is, America being the hot, you know, the hot cauldron of AI at the moment. You know, people probably don't realize in America, everybody's using Perplexity. Everybody's using ChatGPT. It's, you know, it's the new Google. We're not really there in Ireland yet. When we look at America and how polarized it is, we have to imagine that in the future we're going to be offered different leaning sort of chatbots that and AIs that have a particular set of values, and that we are most likely going to see a division of these services where you, if you have a conversation with, you know, your thing when you're writing some marketing, it may not correct you when you talk about, you know, stopping the steal, or you know, it may not correct you when you refer to some of Trump's rhetoric as, even though it's false, it may say, yep, that's about right. That's what we believe in this group, and vice versa on the Democratic side. And that, you know, and political AIs, I think, can actually be a really, really serious danger in the near future. And I think they're inevitable.
Yes, I think that is a danger. I'm worried about that. I talk about that a bit in the book. Mm. I think, you know, this is kind of the ultimate filter bubble, having you know, AI like this. And we've already seen, as you say, you know, it's interesting when Elon Musk started his AI company, XAI, and came out with this chatbot, Grok, he marketed it as anti-woke AI. He claimed that Google's chatbot, Gemini, was too woke, that the answers it gave, you know, had a political slant that was too far left, that it kind of bought into sort of woke rhetoric, and he wanted his chatbot to be completely free of that. So he claimed this was an anti-woke chatbot. You could get it to say much more toxic things, you know, than you could with Gemini or Anthropic's Claude. I it's interesting how that's going to play out. But I think we should also realize that there is an opportunity here because there's some interesting research that chatbots can also be used to break filter bubbles pretty well. There's some interesting research from Cornell University on just how good chatbots are at persuading people to disbelieve conspiracy theories. So they took people who endorsed conspiracy theories. They did an interesting controlled experiment where they exposed some group of them to conversations with a chatbot that was told to act as, in a way to sort of deprogram them. And then they also had another group interact with human specialists who specialize in sort of getting people to disbelieve conspiracy theories and deprogramming people who've been in cults. And it turned out the chatbot was more effective. It was more persuasive and had longer lasting effects than the conversations with the human experts.
Yeah.
And so I think there is potential here to use chatbots in a way that could actually help us rebalance or sort of depolarize our information ecosystem. But the question is, what's the mechanism going to be for that to happen? And you're absolutely right. I mean, you're looking at me skeptically. And I think you're right to be skeptical, particularly in the American context, of how does that happen? And you could very easily see actually it going the other way, where you get, you know, let's say you had a chatbot and it says that, you know, the stop the steal thing, for instance, you mentioned, there's no evidence that the election was actually stolen. Maybe it says that, which is factually correct. But you could see pressure coming now from the Trump administration on, you know, those AI companies to say, your chatbot should not say that. That's, this is clear. And I think that pressure is real. And then what do those companies do in response?
Yeah, big time. And I worry that, you know, those sort of one in a million good stories are used to sort of justify all of the bad that happens. Like we see, you know, small carbon capture or plastic eating bacteria. They're great projects. They're not going to stop climate change. I think we're going to see similar sort of, look at the good AI can do that kind of masks the potential dangers. Jeremy Kahn is AI editor at Fortune Magazine, author of Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future. He is someone who's been covering this for quite some time and has spoken to the people who are holding the keys, as I say. It's a really interesting book. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, Jonathan, thank you so much for having me.
I kind of feel like with those conversations, they are interesting, but we're not really getting anywhere with it, right? We're not really. Well, no, but what I mean is, the future is still murky. What to do is still murky. Like, there is regulation out there, and you can put in specific regulation to say you can't do this and you can't do that. But like, put that in America, and that technology and innovation is just shifted to a country where those rules don't apply. And the EU AI Act is helpful. But I don't know if it's going to really stop a lot of the things that we're kind of worried about. Once off glitches, is it like a GDPR thing? Can you just fine Google $1 billion if it tells a student to kill itself? Maybe you can, and maybe you absolutely should. Maybe if that happens, there's a 3-strike rule and you're out. But like, you know, we do have this expectation of technology to be perfect. And I talk about this all the time. Is there a fine balance? Or when you're talking about something as extreme as that, should that just never happen? And if it happens, that company goes out of business, or their license taken away from them? Like, what do you think?
I think the answer to this is really unsatisfactory, but I think the only real solution is sort of societal, cultural. We have to all shift our thinking. Like, the solution in a way is very simple, but that doesn't mean it's simple to implement.
Yeah.
Solution is, instead of everything you see on the internet assuming it's right until proven otherwise, just flip that as an individual and assume everything you see on the internet or hear on through AI is wrong until proven otherwise, and work on that assumption to start with. And like, because I know that's really unsatisfactory, because you would rightly say, well, loads of people just aren't going to do that, so that doesn't solve the problem. But like, that's what we're stuck with. Like, I think that genie's out of the bottle, two paces out of the tube, and you can look at like all of these, like, put a plaster on this, put your fist in this dam, stop. None of that's going to stop it. It's too late for all of that. And
education is kind of, and media literacy is so important.
You can see it in the US. Like, it's not a new thing. Their education system and the way the knowledge that people have about the rest of the world and about media literacy and the lack of regulation in their media, they've been dealing now for decades with with misinformation and biased information from both sides, and now they just don't know what to believe of ending, and the whole place is seems to be a total mess.
Yeah.
And the only way out of that is to start from the bottom up and have your kids be taught from the very start about, like, rational thinking, philosophy, like Michael D. Higgins said, philosophy in primary school or secondary school, and really, like, drill that into them, make them as informed as possible.
If you have kids, it is an imperative for you to constantly question anything they read on the internet and say, how do you know that happened? Show me the evidence. Did it really happen? And where it didn't happen, say, we need to learn from this.
Yeah.
Just taking stuff randomly from TikTok ads and say, oh, this really happened, or TikTok videos.
And the hard part as well, which we all are guilty of, and myself and yourself obviously included, is think about it when you see something that you agree with or that is from your ideological viewpoint. Just go like, I say that, but do I know that? And if you're not sure that you actually do know it, do a bit of looking into it.
The people with the most confidence are the people you need to have the most amount of skepticism towards.
Yes. Yeah. I always, like, humility is a great attribute in a human being. Like, I think humility kind of leads to wisdom. And when you meet someone, which you often do, and especially among scientists, which I really like about the science community when I'm interviewing a scientist, they'll have that innate humility. They might have like saved millions of lives through some cancer treatment or something. And they're like, oh, well, you know, it was part of a team.
And we know it does this, but we don't know if it does that. I mean, we love it if it does, but we don't know. Yeah,
they never go, I'm the shit. And I'm going to solve this and I'm going to do this.
Some people, but very, very rarely.
Yeah.
All right. Your comments from last week. And really, there's just one I want to respond to. So we got a long email from a chap called Edward. He says, hi, Jonathan. Future Proof is usually a pleasant escape from the mostly dull offerings of Irish weekend radio. It was extremely disappointing, therefore, to hear your interview with Todd Stern on the potential impact of the Trump presidency on global climate. I mean, I know where this is going, but I personally didn't get what I wanted from Todd on that. But anyway, the piece was another nail in the coffin of critical thinking in this country, a tiresome drone from an elitist echo chamber. Mentioned Trump in Ireland and otherwise educated people abandon facts, logic, rigor, and reduce themselves to a bunch of blithering fools reciting political rosary by rote. Archbishop Fintan O'Toole would be so proud, as would the cardinals in the DNC. Ireland, it seems, is the same cultish little backwater it always was. Diversity of positions is constantly talked about but rarely evident, just like the bad old days of the Catholic Church control. The first role of a science broadcaster is objectivity, following the facts wherever they may lead. It is the foundation of trust with listeners. In your interview with Stern, you misled your listeners with a completely false, lazy and intensely boring narrative. Scary Trump, in essence, audio clickbait. I would probably agree with, I'll take a little bit of the boring, but I'm going to address all of this in a bit. You made no reference to the relevance of U.S. oil production numbers under various administrations going back to 2000. You did not compare and contrast administrations. Had you approached this as a scientist, you would see that presidency administrations have little impact. Indeed, you would put aside your subjective bias and bother to do some basic... Had you put aside your subjective bias and bothered to do some basic research, you would see that the blessed saint Barack Obama substantially increased oil and gas production during his 8 years. The most holy Saint Joseph Biden did likewise. Any dip was due to COVID lockdowns. And MAGA Beelzebub Trump did nothing different. By their actions, shall you know them? Ignore the poetry of speeches. Look at what they actually do and did. Had you done some digging, you would know Paris is a greenwashing joke. Here are some stats you could have looked up from the US Energy Information Administration. You showed no curiosity about why the Trump admin withdrew from Paris. I'm not saying whether I agree or not, but had Obama done the same thing, I've no doubt you'd be saying it was the best decision ever. As listeners and citizens, you gave us fake news and propaganda, political rhetoric and scaremongering. Tax-funded broadcasters, scientists and academics are paid to back up their positions with facts and evidence. It's fraudulent to present an opinionated chat at a bar as science. Finally, it would have been interesting to hear something about the impact Elon Musk and RFK are going to have on the Trump presidency. Both are clearly strong in environmental policy and health, but that clearly would not go with your agenda. No doubt it will be hard for you to hear this. I don't doubt your sincere commitment to science, but on this occasion, there were no signs of that commitment at all. And that was from Edward. I think that was recorded before RFK was announced. But look, I do want to respond to some of your comments because I do find Trump scary. In my opinion, based on his reported and undisputed words and actions, he is a mean, vindictive, scared, insecure, and pathetic man. He gaslights, he provokes, and he says impossibly stupid, racist, and insightful things. But the reason I find him scary is because he isn't, to me, it seems, smart enough to see how he's being manipulated by the people who are playing the long game, you know, invested and interested parties, long-held conservative roots, groups who have very, very, I think, scary ideas about what the future should look like. I find him scary because he doesn't know the difference between climate and weather, or still, after many years of it, pretends not to know. This is a quote from Sean Ryan podcast, just August 26th. He said, you know, they've no idea what's going to happen. It's weather. It really isn't weather. I find him scary because he's pledged US energy dominance and everything from new pipelines to new refiners that amp up fossil fuel production. That's from Vox magazine, November 2024. Even though we know these things are going to increase climate change and global warming. He completely flaunts his poor climate credentials, yelling drill, baby, drill from the podium while wildfires rage across the planet and we pass the 1 million climate migrant point. He pulled out of Paris because of the unfair burden that the US taxpayer will have to shoulder, according to him, despite the fact that the US out-emits most developed countries 3, if not 5, to 1. I find him scary because he has shown no respect for the rule of law, authority, or the will of people. I find him scary because he acts in pure self-interest and doesn't hide it. I find him scary because he doesn't hide those things. He does them publicly and as president-elect of a country that has enormous disparity of wealth and more guns than people that are increasingly easily influenced. I don't need to think about both sides. You know, a lot of the time the commentator says, well, what he means is this, and they speak for him. They say, well, he might mean this, or there might be a more benign interpretation of what he says. I don't see the benefit in giving him the doubt. RFK is strong on health, you say, Edward? He has said in 2023, Fox News, that vaccines cause autism. In the New York Post, he said, COVID-19 is targeted to attack Caucasians and black people. This is the guy that's going to be running up health in the United States. In regards to Elon Musk, I was a fan. Like, I did think he was a genius in some ways. And although he didn't invent electric cars or space travel, it's hard to argue that his companies didn't completely transform those industries. But watching his interviews over the past few years have made me think he's just a twat. I mean, like, his thoughts on climate change, while overwhelmingly more agreeable than most of Trump's circle, are completely relevant because they're not his remit. Like, Trump has given him a remit that has nothing to do with climate change. I wish he had, but instead he's looking at efficiency and is planning on basically dismantling a lot of the organizations in America. I don't know what that's going to look like. To be honest, with Musk, I don't really know what's going to look like. I know what his employees have said about him, which isn't always great, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. So I'm not quite sure what Musk is going to do. He does look like a plonker jumping around on stage personally, but I don't know. I've held back on that, but we don't know. Trump has given that role of climate to Lee Zeldin, a businessman who has actually said really next to nothing about climate change for the past 15 years as senator. So it's kind of weird that this guy's gotten the job. But we have heard him talk about how he's going to dismantle this. And we looked at Trump during his presidency roll back 100 regulations trying to protect the environment. So no, I don't give Trump the benefit of the doubt. In the Stern interview, I didn't propose things that could possibly be interpreted differently if you squint really hard or put your fingers in your ears. Anyone I respect and admire, from Mary Robinson to Barack Obama to Ruth Freeman to David McWilliams to Michael Mann to David Attenborough, anyone who has gone and done things that are aspirational, that I admire, that I look up to, they are all afraid of what Trump will do next. It is not a trendy narrative. It is something that I do fear. Those who are not afraid of him or want false equivalence and supposed balance in the face of a very real threat to the planet are people like Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson, the entire horror gallery of Fox News, Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, and the most outwardly racist of all Americans captured on social media. They are the person who are with Trump. Was Paris enough? No. But it was the biggest deal on the environment ever made. Is COP enough? Absolutely not. None of it is enough. But some people are trying. I believe Obama did try, according to an editorial reviewing his environmental record. Steve Cohen from Columbia says, Biden has led the enactment of the largest environmental funding laws ever by an American government. His infrastructure bill and green investment bill of $300 billion or $1.2 trillion and $300 billion respectively are huge investments in environment. Yes, he did increase oil production But you can't look at that one statistic in isolation. And I don't think he's perfect, but no president has a perfect record in an election. But according to Steve Cohen from Columbia, he has the best environmental record of any president in American history. I can't vouch for that. But I don't think it's fair to say they're all the same. And you can't pick out one thing and say, well, because of that one thing, everybody is as bad as each other. Even if you think he's done nothing at all, at least he's not loudly and enthusiastically encouraging people and businesses to work actively to go in the wrong direction and increase emissions. So, I mean, Edward, do you still want objectivity for this man? Like, I don't get it. And I think the objectivity you're looking for isn't objectivity, because objectively, this guy is an asshole. He just is a very bad thing for the planet and something to be feared. So the objectivity that you're looking for, you will not get in this program. Look for it elsewhere.
Yeah, one thing I would say as well, I don't understand why in the face of what he has said, people come out to bat for Trump as if they're on some team. Always remember that both sides could be assholes. You know, just because you don't like Obama, that doesn't mean that Trump is good. Obama good, Trump bad, Trump good, Obama bad. They can both be assholes.
Yeah, and I mean, Edward, in his email, I think, you know...
He does come out to bat for Trump. He kind of...
He does a bit.
He does a bit. And like,
and I think, look, it's just...
There's no need to do that. Like, you can disagree with things that Obama does. You can disagree with things that Bill Biden does. You can disagree with things that Trump does. But you don't need to be on one side of this. That, like, in a lot of cases in politics,
it's complicated.
Oh, people are bad.
Yeah.
That can happen.
And look, I mean... I just find it amazing that people want objectivity, that they want, you know, and that sounds kind of strange. Of course we want objectivity. Well, objectivity is this guy is doing so much that is damaging not just his country, but the entire world on so many different levels in terms of just a culture of being an asshole.
But it is also objective to, like, it's objective to listen to what he says and re-report it. Like he said, it's like that thing you said about people making excuses for him. He said it. It's right there. He said the thing he said. There's no need to explain it.
Yeah, but this one, when he says objectivity, he means reporting both sides and criticizing both sides. But it's kind of like that climate change argument of, you know, we want fairness. We want to hear both voices in the room. When there's one tiny squeaking mouse voice and the loud roar of exasperated and angry climate change scientists who are saying, we are on fire. And like, you know, it's not fair to give both of those airtime or to say, well, you know, on the other hand, Trump is, you know, he did, you know, wear a hat today. Like,
it's actually also not in the guidelines for balance as a journalist, because I have to do these courses every year or two. You know, if something, so for instance, with climate change, when you have like the IPCC report and you have this finding that whatever, I think it used to be 97%, now it's 99 point something percent of scientists in climate, publishing scientists in climate, believe climate change is happening. When you are a journalist, you are perfectly entitled with something like that, climate change, to just go, no, this is what the science says. Because it's the same as like, the theory of relativity. We don't have someone, a theory of relativity denier, come on and go, no, I don't believe in that. It's something that's from a philosophical point of view, yes, we can't really prove anything. But what we do in science is play it by the numbers. If it's 99% likely, it's the most likely answer we have right now.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll learn something in the future that's different, but we don't have that thing now. So most likely climate change is happening and we should do something about it. It's just as simple as that.
Yeah. That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.